BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
It's turned into a European summer for Britain and Keir Starmer. The words have been as warm as the weather. The President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, was here 8 weeks ago for our first joint summit since 2020. She was followed by Emmanuel Macron of France, and he was succeeded by German Chancellor Friedrich Merz. It was almost like the old days, lots of flags and handshaking, and even some agreements made or hinted at. So, is this the beginning of a new, closer relationship with the European Union? Or is everyone just being nice? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's find out what exactly has been happening recently between the UK and the European Union. I'm joined by Peter Foster, World Trade Editor at the Financial Times. Peter Foster, can you remind us what Labour said in its manifesto last year about the UK and the EU and what they do?
So the big thing it said is that they're going to, quote, make Brexit work. What they promised was a reset of relations with Europe, which you'll remember had been very fractious in the era of Boris Johnson and Lord David Frost, and had improved a little bit under Rishi Sunak. That was the general pitch, make Brexit work. But the specifics were more complicated. They also set two red lines, which was no membership of the EU Customs Union and no membership of the EU Single Market. And that limited what they could achieve in this goal of a reset. And that came down to three things. One was a veterinary agreement, which would do a deal with the EU to follow EU rules to reduce and remove all those checks on food and plant products that were moving back and forth across the border. They also promised to do something called the mutual recognition of professional qualifications, which is to make it easier for our lawyers and doctors and dentists to practice in the EU and EU professionals to practice in the UK also. And they also wanted a deal to help touring artists who got hit badly by Brexit to make their life easier. And the last piece was to do an EU-UK security agreement.
Remind those of us who've gone rusty on this, Peter. What does not being in the customs union, not being part of the single market, mean we cannot do with the EU?
Two really important pieces of architecture. The single market basically sets one set of rules for all those goods that are going back and forth. So if you're inside the single market, then all your goods go in friction-free because you've agreed you're going to follow all the rules. You're not going to diverge. If you're part of the customs union, you agree to pay a common external tariff. So all goods going into you pay a common external tariff. And once they've done that, then they can go across borders without any further let or hindrance. But we're outside that. And we've said we're not going to form a customs union with the EU again in this parliament. There was also, after the manifesto, David, another decision, which was to link back with the emissions trading scheme, so the carbon pricing scheme that we'd left when we left the EU, and to relink those carbon markets. And that will be important, I think, for UK manufacturers, because the EU is launching a carbon border tax, as is the UK. And if we have separate carbon prices, that's going to create a load of border bureaucracy. And so the government's decided it wants to relink those schemes too.
What's on to all those other programmes, like the Erasmus programme, you know, the one where you could get to go and study abroad?
So we have actually made a commitment to look at rejoining the Erasmus scheme in the coming negotiation. Of course, the other piece of the puzzle is this whole question of a youth mobility scheme. Now, in the manifesto, the Labour Party didn't go for a youth mobility scheme. It just went for this very limited fix on touring musicians. But they have now agreed to try and agree what they're going to call a youth experience scheme to allow 18 to 13-year-olds on both sides of the channel to live and work in each other's countries for a couple of years. But that negotiation is going to turn around whether we can agree some kind of cap, some kind of limitation, because the current Labour government in the UK is hypersensitive about being accused of restarting free movement or doing anything to massively increase net migration figures.
Peter, what have they actually done since they got into power?
So what they've now achieved, there was a big EU-UK reset summit in London, Ursula von der Leyen, the EU Commission President, and Sir Keir Starmer announcing a big new negotiation, which will start in the autumn, based on this common understanding document, which sets out the key areas where the EU and the UK want to move closer together. So that's the veterinary agreement, some form of youth exchange scheme, the relinking of the carbon markets, and some kind of discussion on touring artists and mobility.
Broadly, that new negotiation coming out of the summit pretty much encompasses what Labour had already said it would do in the manifesto and doesn't go much beyond it.
No, it doesn't go beyond it at all. And I think that's, you know, quite a key point where the UK has tried to look to go beyond it. The EU has said, no, you said no single market, no customs union. And so we can't go any further. And so it's quite a limited reset. By the government's own estimate, the value of this reset will be about a 0.3% uplift to GDP by 2040. Well, you might remember the Office for Budget Responsibility, the spending watchdog, reckons that Brexit is going to cost us 4%. So it's less than 10% of the cost. On those numbers, it's a pretty limited, narrow reset.
Right. Now, who's going to notice the changes most?
I think if you're trading food and drink products, so if you're a supermarket who's spending millions of pounds a year dealing with all that Brexit red tape, all those export health certificates, etc., this will make a huge difference to you. It will remove all those checks at the border. For food and drink exporters and importers, it will be absolutely big bananas. For everybody else who's still wrestling with rules of origin in order to get lower tariff access to the EU, dealing with certification, with different VAT regimes, organic certificates, all that red tape that comes from the UK leaving the single market, if you're into exporting automobiles or part of complex industrial supply chains involving chemicals, etc., this reset deal will do very little for you indeed.
None of this is about tariffs.
No, because we have the trade and cooperation agreement with the EU, and that's a zero quota, zero tariff deal. So as long as your good is sufficiently made in the UK, 50, 60%, that's the rules of origin, then it goes into the EU tariff free. So none of this has got anything to do with a separate issue, which is Donald Trump's tariff war.
Let's just talk very briefly about the mood music, because we not only had the summit with Ursula von der Leyen, but we also had these two big bilaterals with Emmanuel Macron and Friedrich Merz coming to London. Do you, as the World Trade Editor of the Financial Times, now see this as a very significant beginning of a new relationship?
I'm not sure that I do as the World Trade Editor. You know, the manifesto of the Labour Party talked about tearing down the unnecessary barriers to trade. Well, to be clear, the EU-UK reset deal as conceived does not do that. But they also talked about resetting relations with our European friends. And so these big meetings, the first bilateral deal with Germany just signed this month, the first revamp of the Lancaster House agreements with Paris, with France, they are important. They are part of the mood music of the UK getting back in the game in Europe, getting back in the room, working with our joint security. The history of UK post-Brexit relations with the EU suggests that none of that will really read across to the EU giving us concessions on the trade element of the relationship. In fact, the French are perfectly capable of lauding the UK's security contributions and then being really hard nuts when it comes to dealing with the UK. And we saw that, do you remember, in the deal over fish? So when the French want to play hardball, they'll play hardball.
Peter Foster, and before we carry on, just a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes the one which asks whether the tide has turned in the Trump-Putin relationship and what this means for the war in Ukraine, and the one which asks why the water industry is in so much trouble. Back now to the UK's relationship with Europe. I want to find out how significant these developments really are and where are they headed. I'm joined by Jill Rutter, Senior Fellow at the Institute for Government, Anand Menon, Director of the UK in a Changing Europe, and Mojtaba Rahman, Managing Director for Europe at the Eurasia Group Consultancy. Anand Menon, can we just start with a question in principle? Convergence and divergence, can you just explain what they mean?
Yeah, I mean, this is all about whether our rules are the same as those in place in the European single market or not. And if you think about Brexit, the long history of Euroscepticism in this country was one of Conservatives complaining about Brussels regulations. So we all thought this would be a big deal. We'd start stripping away regulations, freeing ourselves. And what we've done is we tried to track this and found that actually we are aligning with Brussels rules.
Perhaps. That's at your institute?
Yeah. We're aligning with Brussels rules perhaps more than we might have envisaged. Now, it's worth bearing in mind that just because we choose to align with Brussels rules doesn't give us market access. What it does mean is it spares businesses the costs of dealing with two separate sets of regulations, and crucially, it mitigates the risks of more checks across the border between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, because Northern Ireland is still bound by many EU rules. Now, to add a further degree of complexity to this, there's something called dynamic alignment. And what that means is we agree with the EU in a specific sector, not only that we'll have the same rules, but we will adapt our rules to keep pace with them under the ultimate jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice. In areas where we agree to do that, we also get market access as well without the checks that pervade all other aspects of the relationship.
So that's a kind of commitment to future convergence in a way. Mujibur Rahman, what in principle, and I'm not talking about the domestic political trade-off here, but what in principle is the trade-off between convergence and divergence?
Fundamentally, the closer the UK government wants to get to the EU economically, the more the government is going to have to give up regulatory autonomy. So if the government does a deal, as I think it's minded to do in the area of agri-food trade, the government will need to align with European regulations for goods trade as they pertain to that sector, not only today, but also in the future. If the government wants to do a deal with the European Union over emissions trading, or with respect to carbon border taxes, or with respect to the EU's electricity market, it will have to align with EU regulations across those sectors. And so I think the fundamental trade-off is the one of control versus economic access, and that's the trade-off that's underpinned the heart of the Brexit debate since 2016.
Jill, can you take us through that a bit more? So the more we converge, the less control we have, and the more we diverge, theoretically, the more control we have.
Yes, I think the key question is, do we agree that we will automatically take EU rules? In which case, clearly, the decision-making is in Brussels, not in Westminster, and we are just saying, you do the rules, we'll follow them, and as Anand and Mitch were saying, in return for that, we'll have better access to the single market in those sectors. Or do we want to retain the right to do something different, to make our own rules, but that comes at a price that it will be harder for our exporters to move goods into both the EU and potentially also Northern Ireland?
Jill, thinking about the future, is there a kind of halfway house here whereby, OK, you're not going to have the right to help make the decision, but everybody will be very keen to consult with you and hear what you have to say and may even kind of change what they're doing to suit you a little bit?
The EU is very clear that they're not going to offer us back a seat at the table because we decided not to be a member state. But equally, they have said that the UK will be involved in something they call decision shaping, which means we'll be consulted when they first think of those ideas, and then we'll have to use our representation in Brussels, the UK mission in Brussels, to lobby quite heavily, find like-minded member states. So if you're Norway, which finds itself in a similar position to the UK here inside the European Economic Area, but not a member state, the Swedes basically represent their interests in the council. We'll be looking around for friendly countries, might be Ireland, might be Sweden, might be Malta and Cyprus Commonwealth members who might suddenly have improbable views on agri-food issues, who might make UK points, but it'll require a heavy diplomatic effort because we won't be there to make the arguments for ourselves in the key decision-making fora.
I have to say there are some wonderful historical ironies in us being represented by Ireland, for example, but I'm sure they'd do it very well. Mij Rahman, will we have to end up paying money to the EU for the right, essentially, to conform to their regulations?
I think it really depends on the kind of collaboration you're talking about. So the very obvious and explicit example that is being discussed at the moment is the government's desire to do more defence industrial policy cooperation together with EU partners. There is a European facility that has been created called SAFE, Security Action for Europe. That's 150 billion euros. If the government wants to borrow from that facility and then use some of that financing to work with European defence manufacturing firms to do a bunch of things like build integrated air defence or create a European drone programme or reinforce the eastern border with Russia, the expectation is the UK government will have to pay a fee to be able to participate in that facility. And so that's a very, I think, clear example where the government will be expected to pay. In the European Council, as it drew up this facility, was absolutely clear on its expectation that if third countries want to participate in this fund, they will have to pay to play.
Jill, you wanted to say something about this.
Well, I think if we do these sorts of agreements, talking about agri-food, joining emissions trading schemes, I think what the EU is like to say to us, well, you're benefiting from that commission bureaucracy. If you were a member state, you would be contributing to those costs through the EU budget, and you don't get that for nothing. The counterpart is we potentially can make some savings in UK bureaucracy, because one of the things we've had to do since Brexit, why it's been a job bonanza for civil servants, is add to our own regulatory capacity to be able to take back some of the functions that used to be exercised for us by the EU. So I think the EU will say there'll be an administrative cost and you need to contribute to that on those schemes, which is a bit different to when we want to be part of a programme. For example, the Conservatives negotiated access to the Horizon programme, one of the EU's big research programmes. All our universities were very keen to be part of that. And we have to make a programme contribution to that. We might see that if we participate in other programmes like the University Exchange programme.
Anand, can we just talk a bit about the Northern Irish issue? This was obviously the great sticking point. It became the big question. Can you explain how all this impacts upon that?
Well, at the moment, Northern Ireland is bound by EU rules in certain sectors. And what we agreed in May at the summit that Peter was talking about was, in some areas, perhaps when it comes to the EU's electricity market, when it comes to agri-foods, when it comes to emissions trading, we might think about negotiating a dynamic alignment agreement. If we do that, it dramatically reduces the burden on that border between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, because we've basically said our rules will be the same as the EU's. And if our rules are the same as the EU's, they're therefore the same as those in Northern Ireland. And what I would say is, one of the reasons why the EU was willing to negotiate these agreements in these areas is because the EU is keen to make the Brexit settlement with Northern Ireland work, which is one of the reasons why I'm sceptical as to their willingness to extend it to other areas. It was in the interest of both sides to do this, partly because it would help us resolve this thorny issue of the GBNI border.
Right. Jill, can we just very briefly look at those areas where it might have been regarded as being in our interest to diverge, and whether we are still able to diverge in them, whether this talk is about maintaining that divergence?
So the big area that wasn't really on the table significantly on the 19th of May was the whole area of services, which is where the UK is very strong. Now, the UK did want to make progress in some areas where, frankly, they were rather rebuffed by the EU. The issue Peter Foster raised about professional qualifications, where I think they basically said we'd talk, and the issue of supporting creative artists who travel. But it was notable, for example, that financial services, a really important sector, wasn't on the agenda. And that is actually where the UK has shown that it wants to do different deals, wants to have a different regime, take a different approach. And the UK wasn't trying to argue we should get back in and regain access to the European market. And frankly, quite a lot of European member states have liked taking some of our financial services business, and I think they wouldn't have probably been in the market for negotiating anything very much there. But we've signed, you know, memoranda with Switzerland, for example, as another sort of non-EU partner with whom we can go off and be significant financial services sectors together. So there are some areas where we haven't done that. There are some areas where it could be mutually beneficial, things like transport services, where you could imagine you might want to raise things. But as Anand said, the EU hasn't said in terms, well, these are baby steps, and actually, you know, by the next summit, and we're committed to have these summits quite regularly, there'll be a whole raft of new bits of the single market. You can go and, you know, here's the bowl of cherries. What do you want this time round after we've done these ones?
And one of the things that we've done a programme about very recently is the government wanting there to be an artificial intelligence hub. Mm-hmm. Is that creation of that hub better served by convergence or divergence?
Well, I think there is a feeling amongst many in the industry that the precautionary principle by which the EU regulates is overcautious and will put off the kinds of investment that you need to try and keep pace with, or at least not fall too far behind the US and China. So I think there are many in the industry who are saying, let's not be as cautious as the European Union. Let's do our own thing. Let's actually try and keep our regulatory framework quite similar to the United States, because there might be opportunities there to work with them. But this is a really interesting issue where there is a danger, I think, that we end up trapped between the two. You know, our biggest security partner over the Atlantic, our biggest trading partner over the Channel. If we start playing pick and mix with regulatory systems, there is a danger, I think, that at a certain point, particularly Midge was talking about collaboration on defence earlier, and a lot of defence stuff is very tied to AI nowadays. So there'll be an overlap there, and it is conceivable, at least, that our desire to be independent of EU rules and to regulate differently might get in the way of some bits of the cooperation we want to do with them.
Mr. McCann, can I ask you about the deal the UK has struck with the US? Now, could we have struck that deal if we were still in the EU? And has the UK ended up with a better deal than the EU might eventually end up with?
Well, I think the UK deal is better than the likely deal the EU will secure with the US. We still don't know what that EU-US deal will look like. The UK government has a framework agreement with the US. All goods exports to the US from the UK are now confronted with a 10% baseline tariff, what Trump calls the reciprocal rate. At the same time, there are very important sector carve-outs for autos, for aerospace, and the government is still negotiating with respect to steel. Those carve-outs came into effect on the 30th of June. This deal was done in principle at the beginning of May. Now, when this deal was announced, I was talking to European trade negotiators in the European Commission, and they were incredibly scornful of this deal. They thought it was a terrible deal, an unhelpful deal, because it sets a precedent at a 10% reciprocal baseline that the Europeans may then need to take into any agreement they strike with the US. And so, you know, there was a lot of rubbishing about what Peter Mandelson and the trade team had achieved. But actually, if we look at where we are today, it looks as if whatever deal the Europeans get from the US is going to be far worse. I mean, at the moment, Trump is threatening a 30% reciprocal rate against all EU goods exports to the US. It probably won't be 30%, but I suspect the number will be anywhere between 15 and 20%. So that's higher than the UK's 10% baseline rate. So yes, I do think the UK has both achieved a quicker and a better deal than they would have been able to do had they remained a member of the EU. And that's come as a massive shock, I think, to many within the EU system who thought, because of the size of the single market, it was a given that any outcome they secure with the Americans would be better.
So what we're basically saying there is that the UK-US deal is a very bad deal for the EU, as far as I can see. Jill, can we look at what are the sticking points on the European side when it comes to cooperating with the UK? What do they really want and what do they really not want?
Well, the EU obviously is 27 member states who will have different interests and different concerns here. The truth was that the EU didn't have a very big shopping list, and the thing that was top of their shopping list, we've already conceded, which was an extension of the fisheries agreement, and that was signed off on the 19th of May at the summit. So they now have access to fishing grounds in our waters on the same basis as Boris Johnson negotiated, but guaranteed for another 12 years, because otherwise that would have expired next year. So it was top of their shopping list. The next thing on their shopping list is this youth mobility, youth experience deal that Peter Foster was talking about. A lot of European countries have said that their young people really miss the opportunity to come work, study, improve their English in the UK. And those numbers have fallen off really, really dramatically since Brexit. I think there's an interesting thing about where's the landing zone on this, because the government took some time to accept that this was something that we were prepared to discuss in principle. And UK ministers keep on stressing that this will be a capped scheme, whereas the EU refers more vaguely to balance. And it may be that the UK's view on this is far too restrictive for the EU. The other thing is, in the original mandate that the EU published before the election, They wanted their students to be able to study at UK universities on the same terms as domestic students. We know that a lot of our universities are not in the best of financial health. I'm not sure the government's sort of going to be welcoming that with open arms, because one of the reasons we left Erasmus was far more EU students came here than UK students went off to
universities. Maybe we should be clear about this. They pay the same student fees as our students. Whereas overseas students coming from any other country pay much higher fees.
Somehow. Pay a lot more, and that's a major source of revenue. Yeah. So very interesting to see whether there's negotiating space on that and how easy that is to land. For the rest, I think there's still going to be this sort of mercantilist approach that, you know, the UK wants to do an SPS deal, but we also want our sanitary and phytosanitary, our agri-food, our veterinary deal, all of these things, same thing. But those deals on rules on food, livestock, plant exports and imports. But the UK also wants some carve-outs. There's some areas where we are doing things a bit differently from the EU, or where new rules in the EU might impact parts of the UK adversely. And be very interesting to see whether the EU said, oh yeah, that's really interesting, we'll make exceptions for the UK. UK has a long history of opting out when we didn't like it as a member state. Very, very different to see whether they will concede those. So I think there'll be a lot of devil in the detail of all of these things. And of course, as we were talking about earlier, that issue about what actually does that UK voice represent, the decision shaping mechanisms, when are we going to be involved? Yeah, what does that look like in practice?
Well, exactly. And what does this all actually amount to? I mean, you can see some people saying, oh, it's reversing Brexit by the back door, and other people saying it doesn't amount to anything at all. What should we make of it?
Well, I think on the one hand, we have far closer relations both bilaterally with individual member states and with the EU than was the case under the Conservatives. But equally, second, it is the case that Labour are now signatories to a Brexit deal that is based on Boris Johnson's trade and cooperation agreement. The Labour Party made a lot of the fact they were going to fix Boris Johnson's botched Brexit, as they said. That Brexit deal, the trade and cooperation agreement, is the centrepiece of our economic relationship. We've tinkered around the margins with it, but actually in real terms, and certainly as Peter Foster was hinting at earlier, in economic terms, this is hardly going to move the dial. So, yep, we're closer friends. We've got Keir Starmer obviously has warm personal relations with European leaders. We are working together in more areas than we were previously. But ultimately, the skeleton, the structure of this relationship remains based on the deal that Boris Johnson negotiated for us.
And that's all we have time for. My thanks to Jill Rutter, Anand Menon, Mishra Rugman and Peter Foster. And my conclusion, we're going to need a separate programme on the politics of all this. The Briefing Room will be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey, Ben Carter and Kirstine Knight. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeley. The sound engineers were Callum McLean and James Beard. The editors were Richard Varden and Lisa Baxter. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Hi, I'm Mariana Spring, and I'm the BBC's social media investigations correspondent. This time on Mariana in Conspiracy Land 2 for BBC Radio 4, I've been investigating the case of Paloma Shemarani, a 23-year-old woman who died of cancer, having rejected chemotherapy in favour of alternative methods. Paloma's brothers say there's more to the story. They say her decision was influenced by the views of their mum, Kate Shemarani, a vocal British conspiracy theorist who shares misinformation about cancer online, a version of events which she disputes. Join me as I try to find out what happened and what Paloma's case tells us about the mainstreaming of anti-medicine ideas. Listen on BBC Sounds.